So hey everybody, welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. I am so happy to be back on the air and back with you. This is your host, Eric Mann, with the show Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. And of course, we're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live on the web at kpfk.org, and carried also on www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com, which is the website for the show that also downloads the show. And I really very much want you to go on that site, check it out, and register. And finally, I can get emails, which I'll talk to you about later, at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. So I've spent a lot of my Christmas and Hanukkah and holiday vacation agonizing and thinking about the film Selma. The film Selma was produced by, among others, Brad Pitt and Oprah Winfrey. It's directed by Ava DuVernay. It's starring David Oyelowo and Carmen Ayogo. It's a very political film. I think a film with very bad and dangerous politics. That doesn't mean I'm right. It just means that I have my politics and the filmmakers have theirs. I think the first thing to understand is, where are we in history? Why is this film so important? It's profoundly important. You need to see it. You need to at least see it through your own eyes, through the eyes, of course, of the filmmakers, and through mine and many others, and make your own decision. I think one thing to understand is, I wrote a book called Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. And I talked about the two revolutions and the two counter-revolutions and the need for a third reconstruction and a third revolution. But now, after having read Gerald Horn's book, the title of which I don't have with me because I was just thinking about in the car, but was talking about the role of blacks and indigenous people in fighting against the original American Revolution, which was in fact a counter-revolution. So now we might think that there were three revolutions. First, there was the revolution of the blacks and the slaves that was overthrown by the American Revolution. The second was the Reconstruction Revolution, that was the Civil War and the ending of formal apartheid, followed by the counter-revolution of Jim Crow. And then the third revolution was the what I call the two decades of the 60s, from 1955 to 1975. And then the third counter-revolution has been from Reagan, and I would still say to the present. And therefore, we need to have a fourth revolution and a fourth reconstruction and figure out how to stop another counter-revolution coming against us. But in that, I still see ourselves in the period of the third counter-revolution. I have to say, and this is just my opinion, that unfortunately I see Selma as part of the ideology of the counter-revolution. And by what I mean by that, it's a film against revolutionary thought. It's a film with a very clear liberal Democratic Party. America is ultimately a moral country, a savable country through moral suasion. And it's a film to make you feel happy about the system and its chances for change, believing in President Obama, believing in President Johnson, believing that moral challenges the system will work, and I don't agree with that. So I've laid out six criticisms of the film. And Clay, are you on the line with me now?
Yes, I am.
Great.
Good to talk to you.
Good
as
to
always.
You absolutely, Clay. And I was telling people that, well, I haven't quite told people yet, but two of my very, very favorite books are Detroit, I Do My Dying by Dan Georgakis and Marvin Serkin, and In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening in the 1960s, written by the person you hear on the air, Clay Carson. I've read In Struggle, oh, at least three or four times. And the reason is because in the work I'm presently doing at the Labor Community Strategy Center, I look to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers as two of the models that are maybe most central to the understanding of what we're trying to do today. So let me go over briefly my critique of the film, And then I wanted definitely to open up to Clay Carson, who was both a fine scholar about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and a brilliant scholar about Dr. Martin Luther King, and also was a very active editor in Eyes on the Prize. So, Clay, you already saw my draft, but I'm just going to lay it out briefly, and then I'd love you to weigh in. Is that okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so here is, as I did some work today, here are the six concerns I have. The first thing about Selma is it does not present Martin Luther King as a black radical, which he was, a critical of capitalism and imperialism in the war in Vietnam, which he was. It presents King's view as metaphysical statements about freedom, the vote, human rights, which was certainly part of his point of view, but it does not show him as a critic of the system or the Democratic Party, because the system and the Democratic Party and his sympathizers produced the film. And to elaborate on that, in all the readings I've done about Dr. King, this man was a brilliant, brilliant intellectual. He's a PhD. He studied theology. He studied rhetoric and speech and world history, and he studied Marxism. And he was a very eclectic thinker, but he was a very anti-system thinker. And I think, in my opinion, the Dr. King that I knew, even by being in Corps and hanging around with SNCC, was at a far more evolved set of how he talked and how he thought than presented in the film. The second is that Selma minimizes the brutal campaign against King waged by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and does not tie it to the COINTELPRO and Kill the Black Messiah tactical plan of the system. That is to say, the film shows a very painful situation that a tape was sent to Coretta Scott King by an FBI agent consciously to sow dissent in the family, in which it basically is trying to tell Dr. King that if he would do his duty to society, he would truly kill himself. In the film, it shows her playing this and followed by certain sexual sounds. And then Dr. King says, "That's not me." And she says, "Of course I know that's not you." But the more fundamental question, and there's a pause, is, do you love the others? And then there's a long pause on his part, and he says no. The problem with that is that while it's a horrible, particularly personal dynamic between King and his wife, I don't think that should have been shown. I don't think that was essential. What should have been shown is that King was fighting off a nervous breakdown, was fighting off massive depression because of the threat of making the tapes public, not of that tape, but of tapes in his hotel room. Clay, when I was in Corps, we knew about this. We knew that when King criticized J. Edgar Hoover because he said the FBI was not protecting civil rights organizers in the South, either Hoover brought him in or he demanded a meeting, and at that meeting, Hoover presented him with tapes of his activities in hotel rooms that absolutely devastated him. And the idea that through this whole Selma situation, that was going on was not shown in the film. The third is, I believe Selma whitewashes the Democratic Party. It makes it look like you just have a hard-headed Lyndon Johnson who already passed the Civil Rights Bill, which was very, very good. In fact, Johnson, in my opinion, was very good on civil rights in a certain context. When John Kennedy was killed and he assumed office, the first thing he said, which is a political choice, is the greatest gift you can give to John Kennedy is to pass a civil rights bill. That was a very important choice. And he also understood, as he said, that he knew he was giving away the South, away from the Democratic Party, to the Republicans for what he thought was a generation. He did not know it would be maybe almost forever, and that it's the black South that's going to have to take back the South. The white South is still pretty hopeless. But more importantly, it indicates that the president is just sitting in his office deciding what to do. And King is telling him to pass a voting rights bill. It doesn't say, Dr. King, the people who are shooting you and beating you down South are Democrats. The Democrats, as Malcolm X pointed out, control all the committees. The Southern Democrats are not going to vote for the Civil Rights Bill, which they didn't. They're not going to vote for a voting rights bill. In fact, I need Republican votes, which is the only way we can pass this, is I need Everett Dirksen's vote, who is from Illinois. Well, that would have shocked the audience. Wait a minute. The Democrats did not vote for the Civil Rights Bill, and the Republicans voted for the Civil Rights Bill? Well, in fact, some Republicans, some Democrats did. But if you're trying to push the Democratic Party, which I believe this film is, you can't introduce essential information that without the Republican Party, there wouldn't have been either a Voting Rights Bill or a Civil Rights Bill. The next is it says that the film acts as if moral challenges to those in power work and does not explain the most minimal truth about democracy in a capitalist system, an imperial empire, or the critical role of communist support for the civil rights movement that pushed the U.S. ruling class to act. I think all of us in the civil rights movement knew, and I'm happy to say I was there. I was there in 1964 with the Congress of Racial Equality. I was in the North. I was not in Mississippi Summer. I was in Harlem Fall. But still, we knew that without the Soviet Union's pressure, without the fear of Africa going communist, that all the abuses happening in the United States did not have an international audience. So when we said the whole world is watching, we meant the third world is watching. And I think that should have been in the film because the filmmakers knew it. You can't omit facts that are right in front of your face without making a conscious choice that that's what you did, and that's what they did. The other thing is I think that it leaves out Vietnam. It whitewashes Vietnam in February of 1965 when much of the Selma struggle jumped off was also the time that Lyndon Johnson bombed the North. It was a war crime. It was a crime against humanity. He had just come to power in his second term, and after telling Goldwater that he was going to be more moderate on Vietnam, he bombed Vietnam. I know that Dr. King was outraged about that. What he did about it is different, but a true film about King would have shown King talking to Andy Young, talking to Harry Belafonte, talking to John Lewis about the dilemma of what to do, and I don't know, you'll tell us when, Clay, but SNCC came out with Hell No, We Won't Go very early, and by the April 1965 SDS March against the war in Washington, Bob Moses gave an amazing speech about we have to understand colonialism in Vietnam and colonialism in Mississippi. Finally, I think Selma consciously tries to put down the black radical and militants of SNCC and dramatically understates the unity and affection that existed between King and the young radicals, but also does not explain the very real political disagreements and conflicts. As such, it does not teach people the complex skills of movement building, alliances, and the Black United Front. The basic argument about King that all of us knew, and I'm proud to say us, meaning Core and SNCC, was the criticism of Dr. King was he would come in, we would call parachute, come into a community, bring with him tremendous attention to the struggle, which is very positive, high visibility, which is very positive, but he would often take over the political movement. He often did not build the grassroots strengths on the ground, which SNCC and CORE were trying to do. In the film, he also, as you know, turns around the march, and there's a whole long story about that, without consultation. But also, sadly, is that after King and SCLC left Selma, they left it somewhat in a shambles, partly out of just their own limitations as an organization. They promised food to people that had lost their jobs, but they couldn't deliver the food. That's not even a particularly bad criticism of SCLC. It was what it was. They weren't capable of putting together such an operation. But I would have loved to hear the actual conversation between King, John Lewis, and Jim Foreman in the debate that they were having. I think we could have learned so much about the complexity of black thought that was totally caricatured in the film. Selma glorifies nonviolence as the only tactic for the movement and attacks anyone who supports armed self-defense or even direct action militancy. So the story about, there's a scene in the film where somebody gets very angry after Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed and after all the violence is, we should get a gun and shoot them. And then someone else, I forget who it is, says, are you crazy? They have all these guns. We have very few guns. That's a crazy idea. Well, several things. First of all, very few black people are really saying, let's go out and shoot the folks. It was a sentiment. It was not a tactical proposal. But the most important thing is that black people were arming themselves for self-defense. Black people were having guns in their cars. They were having guns in their homes, as you pointed out, Clay, in Struggle and all the other studies I've read, is you can't imagine how many more lynchings there would have been if it hadn't been from black GIs coming back, arming their families, arming themselves, at least for self-defense. And that conversation, which took place, I remember being with CORE, in which Jim Farmer, a just as militant nonviolent person as King, stood and says, I'm super nonviolent, but I want to thank the Deacons for Defense who are here protecting those of us who are trying to carry out nonviolence in the South by having guns. And why couldn't that have been in the film? At each point, I think these are very conscious omissions. They're very conscious political statements on the part of the filmmakers. That's why I do not think overall this is a very progressive or helpful film. Clay Carson.
So now it's my turn.
You got the whole rest of the show, brother.
Well, I agree with every point that you make. However, I think it's good to start this discussion by saying that I don't expect a lot out of Hollywood versions of history. And so, therefore, after waiting 50 years to have Hollywood make a film, a serious film, major film with, you know, $10, $20 million budget about Martin Luther King, I think it's important for us to recognize that that can have, even this critical discussion can have a positive outcome. And I remember some 30 years ago when Color Purple came out, and, you know, you had all these talented people who were responsible for the book, for the film, for the acting, and all of this, and probably would have won the Best Picture Award and all of that, except for the controversy that was within the black community about whether this was a good portrayal of black males, which, of course, it wasn't. It wasn't meant to be that way. So I hope that our discussion about the film gives recognition to the fact that there was a lot of talent there, that you have a black woman directing a major film, which is almost unprecedented. You have a lot of very talented black actors who contributed to that film. And I think that in the discussion about whether Hollywood did not make a film that was revolutionary rather than liberal, of course Hollywood is not. Hollywood is part of capitalism, and it's not going to make a film, even a major film, I don't expect that ever to be made about SNCC. So I think that what we need to do is use this film as a way of making a point that the movement to overthrow the Jim Crow system had a liberal element and it had a radical element. And I think you're right to point out that both SNCC and King were part of the radical element, who felt that the movement needed to go beyond civil rights reform. And both of them, when the Voting Rights Act was passed, no one I knew in SNCC retired. Martin Luther King certainly didn't retire.
Right.
If anything, they stepped up the intensity of what they were doing because they understood that overcoming Jim Crow was simply a stage and a longer process. And when we're still in that, what you refer to as that third stage, we are, if you think of overthrowing slavery being the first stage, overthrowing Jim Crow as the second stage, we're in the third stage now.
That's right.
And I think that if the discussion about the film is not about whether or not it was a good, honest portrayal of history, that's not something. If you want a good, honest portrayal of history, you're more likely to get it from reading a lot of the books that have been written rather than going to a film. But on the other hand, probably millions more people will see the film rather than read my book or any of the books that have been written, even someone like Taylor Branch, who's, you know, had a bestseller. The audience for that is dwarfed by the audience for the film, so therefore we need to use the film. And I recommend that everyone who is seriously progressive and understands that that was one stage in the movement, that we need to move on to the next stage, it's good to have a film that glorifies the fact that we had a victory at one point, that the kinds of obstacles to voting that existed in 1965 were at least modified by the Voting Rights Act. And of course that wasn't a radical piece of legislation because, as you said, it was basically written by Republicans whose support was vital to get that passed. So you're not going to get a piece of legislation that makes the simple point that everybody should be voting, which should be our position if you believe in electoral systems at all. It should be universal participation, that
right.
Nobody should be excluded from voting. And in fact, we should do everything possible. We should be like countries that if you're not only don't prevent people who have been to prison from voting, but bring the ballot to your prison cell so that you vote.
Well, Clay, let me ask you this, because
I think that we need to, I think the discussion should be, what is the distinction we need to make between the reform, and the civil rights movement was a reform movement, and it was a successful reform movement, and the main difference that I remember between SNCC and Martin Luther King is that Martin Luther King was willing to do what was necessary to make sure that the reform would happen. SNCC was more willing to push the issue and say, we want more than that. We want more than simply a watered-down Voting Rights Act, just like they wanted more than a voting watered-down Civil Rights Act.
Well, let me ask you this, Clay.
The question is, where do we go from here? That's the question that King was asking at the end of his life.
Well, let me stay in I have some thoughts, but I want to help you elaborate your own more, because I think it's very important to hear your voice and for me to learn from you. I mean, obviously, I just want to say again, I want every one of our listeners, I don't know if you heard the introduction, you have to go see this film. It's a very, very important film. It's a cultural landmark for the black movement, and therefore, like all good films, as I said, the filmmakers have politics, I have politics, I don't share their political interpretation of those events, but God, yes, go see Selma for sure, and stay, as I said, and debate, all the different ideas, and yes, read books like In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening of the 1960s. So let me stay, because you spent so much time in both your understanding of SNCC and your understanding of Dr. King. And I was telling my wife, Leanne, that I study this and study it, and the more I study it, the more complicated it is. It's such a, how do you understand Black Reconstruction in America? How do you understand all this complex history? Tell me, in your own mind, how you see the intersection of SNCC, how do you see the intersection of SNCC and King in their actual relationship to each other in real time? Help our listeners understand the complexity of their relationship.
Well, I remember having a long discussion with Stokely Carmichael, then Kwame Ture, later, about that. And he told me that about his admiration for King, that he spent time over at King's house. He went to his church. He felt that King was an extremely brave individual. I mean, he had to have known. Martin Luther King put his life at risk almost every second of his life, his adult life. So I think that there was that understanding that he was a person to be respected because of his contribution. They had a difference of opinion, and that difference was not so much that King wasn't a revolutionary and Kwame Ture was. I don't think that was the difference. I think King, when you look at him closely in terms of his goals from an early age, I think I've talked to you, Eric, about the letters that he wrote to Coretta back in 1952, and he's talking about looking forward to the day when there will be a nationalization of industry.
Right.
Now, that doesn't sound like a reformist to me when he's talking about overcoming capitalism, and he was a strong critic of capitalism. So King was as radical as, and in fact, some of the people who were trying to say, I'm more radical than King then, when you look at where they ended up, you know, someone like, that sometimes radical.
Were you about to name names?
Elders Cleaver, for one.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Sometimes radicalism becomes an excuse for not doing effective politics.
Well, let me respond to this.
You're always criticizing those people who are successful in terms of grassroots politics, which is a very difficult thing to do because you can't go in and do effective grassroots politics talking about the end goal all the time, because people want something between overthrowing capitalism and what they got now. And if you're not giving them some positive reinforcement in terms of victories, and that's why we need to celebrate something like the passage of the Voting Rights Act, because it was a victory of struggle. And at the same time say, but it's not the end of the struggle.
Well, let me ask you this, Clay, and everybody who you're listening to is Dr. Claiborne Carson. He's the director of the Martin Luther King Research and Educational Institute at Stanford University. He's also the curator of all the King papers. He's also a primary editor of the Eyes on the Prize Reader, and I'm assuming the whole film series as well. And he spans all the different progressives and radical tendencies in the civil rights movement. I guess the thing I'm trying to say, Clay, is that I think one of the weaknesses of the film is that SNCC also believed in winning reforms. SNCC was not a purist organization. The debate between SNCC and King was a lot, in my opinion, about building long-term structures of black resistance on the ground, and what was the relationship of a particular tactic to would it strengthen or weaken the particular movement. I think you know very well, I mean, better than me, but I remember Fannie Lou Hamer, one of the great transformative experiences of my life. She came to Newark, New Jersey, where I was working with Tom Hayden and a whole group of black residents, you know, in Newark. And Fannie Lou Hamer spoke to us for 3 hours about the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party struggle. And she said, look, I want to be very clear. They said that we wouldn't take the compromise, that we wouldn't compromise. That's not true. But in compromise, there are winners and losers. We were offered a terrible deal that was not a compromise. If they had offered us that they would seat half of our delegation and half of the Lily White delegation, we would have taken that, because that would have been a massive blow to the regular Mississippi delegation. But they gave us no votes. Similarly, I think the thing I wish the film could have shown is SNCC and CORE and Dr. King and Bayard Rustin were all in a black united front to make Selma happen and to make the Voting Rights Act happen. And that Jim Foreman, after saying, we're not going to participate, right? We're not going to participate. He ends up jumping in, as do all the SNCC volunteers, as you say in your book. And first SNCC said, well, we're going to boycott it. Then they said, well, people can go as individuals. And then the next thing you know, lots of SNCC people went to Selma, and Foreman himself participated actively. Is that accurate?
Yeah. What happened is a lot of the SNCC people went to Montgomery, just bypassed the march,
right,
and started demonstrations in Montgomery.
Right.
But I think that to say that SNCC was right and King was wrong is a simplification.
I think you're still not hearing what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm saying that SNCC and King were allies.
Yeah.
And
no,
were not primarily having a debate. I mean, they were having a debate, but I was not arguing. I don't think that was the primary aspect of their relationship, is one thinking the other was right or wrong. I think King had great respect for the SNCC people, and SNCC people had great respect for King. And that's my biggest critique of the film, is the way it counterposes them.
Yeah, I would agree with that completely. And one of the things that I would find very interesting would be a film about the discussions, tactical, strategic, ideological discussions that were going on.
Right.
I spend in the In Struggle book, that's the whole middle of the book, is those debates. I call it looking inside, you know, that These debates are about issues that are still with us today. So I think that they are very, very important. I'm not so sure that a Hollywood film would be the best place to put those discussions, even in Eyes on the Prize, which I think is a much better portrayal of that history.
Right.
A lot of that gets submerged because there was no footage of that. And Eyes on the Prize was about the events where you had news media doing footage. And the critical meetings took place without a filmmaker there. It's very rare that you get a documentary film, even, that gets to the heart of grassroots organizing. Can you think of a really good film that gets at that issue?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I actually think Norma Rae was quite sophisticated, to my surprise. There's also a film by Marcello Mastroianni called The Organizer in Italy that I thought was particularly terrific. But what you're right about is they're rare.
I would grant you.
But I'm totally agreeing with you that we could do it on one hand at the whole number of films that we're talking about.
Yeah, and those films had politically knowledgeable people writing the script, making the film, and they gave and one of them was not, by the way, neither of them actually was a big budget Hollywood film. Both of them are what we would now call independent films.
That's right.
And to a large degree, this film was too. It was not like one of the big Hollywood studios suddenly decided, let's do a film about Martin Luther King. You know, DreamWorks had been talking about that for many years, and they never got around to doing it. And it really came from the initiative, in Hollywood terms, came from the grassroots of Hollywood, and that's the independent filmmakers.
Well, tell us a little bit about the actors, if you know some of it. Tell us about the director, because obviously that is very important. What do you know much about the sort of story of some of the players in the film?
Well, a lot of this came from the initiative of the actor Oyelowo, who David Oyelowo was the guy who played King, and he got a script by the last name is Webb. I'm forgetting his first name at the moment, but anyway, the script had been going around Hollywood 7-8 years ago. And a number of other scripts were also circulating around Hollywood, and none of the Hollywood studios felt that the script, it wasn't even a question of whether the script was good enough, it wasn't, the film would not make money. That's really the bottom line.
Right.
And it was his faith in going to Oprah Winfrey that got the ball rolling, and only in the last 2 years. It happened that, you know, I was actually hoping to write a script about King, and I did write one. But the difficulty really comes not from the material, you know, getting good writers to write scripts. It really comes from the conservatism of the people with the money and this belief, which is sometimes fulfilled at the box office, that black people don't want serious films about the movement. I don't think that that's true. I think they don't want to watch bad films about the movement, but there is an audience out there for it, and there should be. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to start my comments by saying, go see the film. Don't allow this film to get hurt by people like us saying, well, there's historical inaccuracies in it, and it doesn't fit our view of what the movement was really about, or even what King was really about. That shouldn't prevent people from going and judging for themselves. And hopefully this discussion will allow them to come into the film with a perspective of what it doesn't say and what another film might say. You know, I think it would be very interesting to look at King and understand him as a radical who was pushed into the role basically by Rosa Parks of being a liberal civil rights leader. And I think he did that very effectively for 10 years. But during all that time, he understood that civil rights reform was just part of his agenda. If you go and look at his speech that he gave at the when he received the Nobel Peace Prize, he makes clear that his agenda is about ending poverty throughout the world, ending war throughout the world, as well as trying to deal with racial injustice.
Well, let me ask you this, Clay, because I mean, I want to stay for this on a minute. I mean, I think I don't want to keep saying it, but I think I made it very clear that this is an important film, and I don't think being very critical of a film's politics.
Oh no, I'm just.
No, it's important to
I'm
say.
Just saying that
no,
why,
I want to
why,
say something. I want. We both agree that people should go see the film. It's a black film. It has a black director. I started out by saying Selma's a political film. I do not at all agree with its politics. In fact, I think they set the civil rights and black liberation struggle back. Selma is a historical film. I do not agree with the filmmaker's interpretation of history. This is not a criticism. The filmmakers did not agree to make the film that I think is warranted. They made their own film, which you should go and see. So I think we both agree that what I was getting to is these were very political filmmakers. They made a film based on a politics that they thought was the best reflection of their own ideas. If you want to make, you know, when we went and saw it, I was happy to say we went and saw it in the ArcLight in Hollywood. It was wall to wall. We got the last two seats in the second row. So we want people, let's just say it again and again, we want our listeners, the whole purpose of the show is to bring attention to that film. I plan to go back and see it one more time because I want to, you know, read it through other eyes. So if I did not make it clear enough, being critical of film, the reason we're giving it a full hour is because of how important the film is. And we do want our listeners to go see it.
And I think that the biggest part of the Hollywood myth in making films about historical subjects is what I call the great man myth. As great as Martin Luther King was, Selma or something like it would have happened if King had never been born. Hmm. And I think we need to recognize that. And sometimes this desire to create a heroic role at the center of a film is part of what we as political people need to criticize also. Because when you look at history from the bottom up, you recognize that Rosa Parks had much more to do with the creation of the Martin Luther King we know. And Martin Luther King had nothing to do with what Rosa Parks started in Montgomery. That she would have started that if Martin Luther King had never come to Montgomery. He was not responsible for her. She was responsible for him. And I think as long as we keep that clear, then we can admire both of these people and understand that movements arise from the grassroots. When we are very fortunate, out of a grassroots movement, a great leader can emerge. But both of these processes need to take place. And the same, I would say the same thing about Gandhi. He did not start the Indian independence movement. Nelson Mandela did not start the South African anti-apartheid movement. Neither of them was responsible. Gandhi was not responsible for India gaining its independence. It would have gained its independence if Gandhi had never been born.
Well, let me say that. You finish, Clay. I'm sorry.
So I think that's the major critique I would give. And if you had a film that gave due attention, I think both of us would be happy if the film had paid more attention to people like Diane Nash,
right?
Who is in the film. But she's there as decoration. She doesn't say very much. Someone as colorful as Jim Bevel,
right?
Which I think a character actor would have had a field day with if they had written some lines for him.
Right.
In other words, I think that my feeling and the reason why I took the time to engage in screenwriting is that I think real history is actually more interesting than the phony version of it that we often get on the screen.
Well, let me say a couple of things, Clay. I mean, in response to this very interesting conversation. And first of all is that I do believe that the social movements and the great people theories are intersected in all the best ways. I mean, I just interviewed, you know, 15 people at the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, Clay, you know, and I, for instance, I had a long interview with Dave Dennis from CORE, and I told him, you were my first hero. When I was in Northern CORE, and he came up from the South and told us that we better get our priorities straight and that the South was the center where things were, and he needed more money, he needed more staff. I was 22 years old, and I thought, oh, my God, this guy is like a major figure. I met Bob Moses, you know, Ella Baker. We're lucky. You know, I mean, movements do bring forward amazing people, Medgar Evers, including Martin Luther King, and we desperately need them, and when they're killed, the loss is enormous. So I think we're both trying to grapple with the dialectic, right, between social movements and the essential role of leadership. And then the second point I wanted to make is make your film, because I think in this period in history, I think you're right. We can't ask Hollywood to say what we want to say, but given the technologies, I think people should be doing more documentaries, more, if you could do a dramatic rendition, which is much harder to do, if you could write a script, I don't know what the money is involved, but isn't the possibility of doing a so-called low-budget film that could still get out to the movement? You know, I mean, it wouldn't be instead of Selma, but I would love if you did that film.
You know, actually, in Hollywood terms, Selma was a low-budget film.
That's right. That's right. $20 million.
It definitely, all of us would benefit if they took one of these comic book films that cost $200 million.
Oh, my God.
And divided
right.
that up into 20 films that could change the world, you know, but that's not likely to happen.
Well, I have two things to say before you. We have about 8 minutes. Since the film didn't say it, tell our listeners a little bit about Jim Bevel. Tell us, our listeners, a little bit about Diane Nash.
Well, let me start with, first of all, it doesn't even mention that they were married.
Right. I was just thinking of that as I said it.
But Diane Nash is just someone, she should have a film made about her. She was just so essential to the Freedom Rides campaign.
Right.
And such a dedicated, courageous person. When we think about Martin Luther King, you know, he was actually very reluctant to engage in civil disobedience, and that's kind of surprising when you
right.
think about it.
That
he very rarely voluntarily went to jail. Well, people like Diane Nash were, from their beginning of their adulthood, willing to go to jail, eager to get arrested, because if necessary, they would stay out of jail. But you know, the jail was not a deterrent, even at the cost of their lives. You know, the Freedom Rides, they didn't know whether they would survive the Freedom Rides. They wrote out their wills before students went on those rides. And Jim Bevel was I would call him, you know, one of these people who, on the verge of whether he was sane or not, you know. I mean, right. in some ways he would come up with ideas that were so audacious, you know, and that's what King actually liked about him, you know, and other people on SCLC didn't like him at all, but he was the one who was, he and Diane were the ones who actually first proposed doing something radical in Alabama to get the right to vote, and promoted the idea of after Jimmie Lee Jackson's death, marching up to the Capitol and demanding that George Wallace do something.
Wow.
You know, she is the type of hero that I think people need to know more about, you know, and Bevel had aspects of his personality which were not so admirable, but on the other hand, he played a crucial role in Birmingham and the Freedom Rides and in Selma.
Well, let me tell our listeners a couple of things. You're listening to, that's Clay Carson, Dr. Claiborne Carson, of Stanford University, just a tremendous both movement person and movement scholar. This is Eric Mann at Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. A couple of things before we leave. The first thing is, I would love to get short film reviews from our listeners. Send it to Eric at Voices from the Frontlines, which means you've got to go see Selma. And write up a paragraph or two, and I'll read some next week. Eric at Voices from the Frontlines, so you got to go see the film if you want to send me a review. Secondly, you could send me tweets at Eric Mann Speaks. I won't read them on the air because I'm not quick enough, but if you send it to me now, I'll read some of the tweets next week as well. So I think it's really important. One thing I wanted to say to our listeners is that, you know, we've been going to the phones a lot, and one of the problems I have to say last year is that some amazing people go to the phones, but then some people go to the phones who are not really trying to help the show, but they have a speech they want to give that almost has nothing to do with the show. So I want to focus more on those of you who write. I want to focus by sending your ideas to Eric at Voices from the Frontlines. Respond to what Dr. Carson said. Respond to what I say. Have a third and fourth and fifth opinion. And I want to make reading listeners' ideas a more integral part of Voices from the Frontlines. So that I expect to hear from you at Eric at voicesfromthefrontlines.com. And next week we'll make our first trial run. Clay Carson, what do you think is the primary laudatory aspect of the film Selma that most strongly recommends it to our listeners?
I think that it is that it makes history come alive in a way that I wish I could in my books. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's the accuracy that you would get from reading a serious work of history, but I'm one who goes in part not so much to look at the plot of a Hollywood film, it's kind of the development of a hero, but rather looking at what was it like living back in that time? What was it like confronting a Southern sheriff? What was it like going into a voter registration booth, office to try to register to vote? Try to get some sense of what the past was like. Because I think that that's very necessary for us, especially during times like this when there's lots of reasons for pessimism. We're still fighting police brutality 50 years after Selma.
That's right.
That during that time, we need to remind ourselves, lots of things haven't changed, but some things have changed.
Absolutely. And I want to end by saying this, that folks, go see Selma and go on Amazon or any other place and go to get the book In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening in the 1960s. I think you underestimate your dramatic capacity. There's a great story about Stokely, how he goes out into the fields and they say, "Are you with Dr. King?" And he says, "You got to be crazy to say no." He said, "Of course I'm with Dr. King." And he was trying to explain to the SNCC people that the only way you had access to some of the areas is to say, "Of course I'm with the Dr. King." And I could tell 10 other great stories from your book. So, Clay, it's great to have you on the show. We'll have you on, of course, again. Thanks for the wonderful work you do. I want to thank our producer, Crystal McMillan, who really does a terrific job. I want to thank G, our engineer, who always helps us line up the guests and make things right and give me the signals. I do want to thank the filmmakers of Selma and, again, urge our listeners to go out, read it, see it, make your own decisions, and yes, send me comments at Eric at voicesfromthefrontlines.com, and you can send me comments now about what you think about the show, what you thought about this conversation. I don't know where we'll be next week, but we'll be in the heart of the revolution again. We welcome you back. I'm super happy to be back on Voices. All power to the people. Take good care of yourselves.